Darn, did you have any hand in clapping?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming. This is the soapbox panel. And I think it'll be interesting. Well, basically, there's a philosophical divide in the conservation community over how to achieve more wilderness protections in this country. Here in Montana, that divide is increasingly evident over a recent bill introduced by Democratic Senator John Tester. Senator Tester introduced the first new piece of wilderness legislation brought by a Montana politician in more than 20 years last summer. In a nutshell, Senator Tester's Forest Jobs and Recreation Act proposes four main objectives. First, it would create about 600,000 new acres of wilderness in Montana. It would remove congressional protections for two wilderness study areas currently managed as wilderness, while undesignating five more wilderness study areas. It directs the Forest Service to mandate minimum logging levels on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge and Kootenai National Forest, with the goal of maintaining the state's dwindling wood products industry. And it guarantees motorized recreation opportunities on certain public lands. This proposed legislation is a result of years of work by the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Partnership, a collaborative group anchored by three conservation groups and five timber mills involving other conservationists and motorized recreation users. And this proposal is billed by its supporters as a Made in Montana approach to breaking the decades-long wilderness gridlock that's prevented new wilderness from being created here since, what was it, 83? Mm-hmm. And it's also aimed at boosting the state's wood products economy and creating new opportunities for motorized recreation on public lands. But other conservationists see this bill as an example of political deal-making run amok with potentially serious long-term repercussions for the future of public land management. With us today to discuss this complex and timely issue are Tim Baker, Legislative Campaign Director for the Montana Wilderness Association, George Nickus, Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, and Martin Nye, Professor of Natural Resource Policy here at the University of Montana. And I'm not going to take up too much time talking or moderating. I'm going to let these gentlemen introduce themselves for a few minutes and help us frame this discussion. So, Tim?
Okay. Thanks, John. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things about what the bill does, because I think one of the things, Forest Jobs and Recreation Act introduced by Senator Tester, which I am, I'll just state clearly right away, an unabashed supporter of. One thing that John mentioned among the four different pieces of the bill that he omitted was it also has a very heavy emphasis on restoration. And so on a lot of these public lands that we're talking about, there are issues with fisheries health, forest health, wildlife habitat issues that the bill also makes as one of the key legs of the stool as an area of focused activity. So while you'll have, you know, it looks at the forest as a whole, and while you'll have wilderness designated, which of course to the Montana Wilderness Association is a big deal, you'll also have on the front country and the roaded landscape, places that are already developed, you'll have a lot of activity doing restoration work, rehabilitating fisheries, trying to deal with forest health issues, and trying to improve or fix wildlife habitat where there are existing problems. So that's also a big component of it. There are also, in addition to the wilderness and restoration piece, there are performance directives. You could call them mandates. They're not exactly logging mandates, as they were described. They're actually mandates to do a certain amount of mechanical treatment on public lands, and they have specific acreage requirements that are to be met. So, for example, on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Forest, it would be, you know, 5,000 acres of mechanical treatment. So mechanical treatment includes lots of different activities, not just a commercial timber harvest. It can include thinning for fire danger, It can include taking material as small as this cup is round. So obviously it embraces a broad spectrum of activities. And then the fourth component is it does create a number of recreation areas across the region that are directed at motorized and mechanized use. And so where motorized and predominantly where motorized and mechanized use is already happening on the landscape, okay, the provisions of the bill give some force and direction to those activities while still preserving the authority of the agency to protect other resources. So I just want to make sure you have this kind of clear picture of what the bill does. And then there are not just, it's not just the Beaverhead Deer Lodge. There are actually three different places in the state where this bill operates. One is the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Forest, which is the largest piece of the bill. There is also a smaller component of the Blackfoot on the Seeley Lake Ranger District, and then another component up in the Kootenai Forest in the Yaak Valley up on the Three Rivers Ranger District. So you were where you would have kind of this vision, total management vision being applied to the landscape. I brought some material on it too over there if you want to take a look at it. Let me just give you a couple of comments here. Wilderness is about places and people. But wilderness designation, which requires an act of Congress to take effect, is about politics. To pass a wilderness bill for any given state, there must be significant support among that state's everyday citizens. This is really important because legislative tradition requires the support of the state's congressional delegation. It doesn't mean that every member has to sign off on it, and certainly not every member has signed off on John Tester's bill. But it does mean that there has to be real support for it within the state. And so it has to understand these are public lands, these are national issues, but the legislative tradition, and we can talk about it later, I think there's a reason for that. The legislative tradition requires that there be significant support within the state. Now, as John mentioned, unfortunately in Montana, it's been 27 years since New Wilderness was designated in Montana, and that's tragic. And when you deal with an issue that revolves around politics, which are kind of the moment, right, we've had plenty of that this year, going 27 years without accomplishing your agenda can be pretty devastating.
Tim, we're going to move on to George,
sure.
And then we'll probably get back to some of your points throughout the discussion.
Well, thanks, John. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with all of you. As John mentioned, I'm the executive director of Wilderness Watch here in Missoula. Wilderness Watch is a national organization that focuses our work on, we're essentially a citizen watchdog organization to ensure that lands that are designated as wilderness, part of the National Wilderness Preservation System, are administered in a way that preserves their wilderness character, preserves those values for which they were set aside. A lot of people think that you know, once wilderness is designated, all it takes is a law and everything is okay. But it just simply isn't the case. It takes, essentially eternal citizen vigilance to ensure that these areas are preserved. There are lots of pressures, lots of special interests, a tremendous lack of commitment on the part of the federal agencies that oversee these areas to preserve them as wilderness. And so that's what Wilderness Watch does. Now, typically, we have not been directly involved in wilderness bills per se, arguing over what gets designated and what doesn't. We worry about areas after they're designated. But we've had to change, we've had to shift a little bit in recent years because of a number of wilderness bills, like a lot of these quid pro quo kind of wilderness bills that have been passing, because what our experience has taught us over the 20-some-odd years that we've been in existence is that a lot of these bills carry a lot of special provisions that allow things to occur in wilderness that are typically not allowed, that are prohibited generally in wilderness. And as a result of all of these special provisions, We've seen them have a pretty deleterious effect on wilderness stewardship of lands in the National Wilderness Preservation System. You know, that system, even though it's not its own set of lands, it's kind of an overlay of protection on existing federal reserves, whether they're national forests, national parks, refuges, or BLM-administered lands. That system at 110 million acres is the largest sort of land preservation system that we have in the country. So it's a lot of country, and when there's legislation that affects it, it's something that really grabs our attention. Now, I'm also here on behalf of an organization called the Last Best Place Wildlands Campaign. And it's a campaign. It's not really an organization. It's a campaign that was organized by, I think there's 40-some-odd groups now that are part of it that have concerns about Senator Tester's bill and many of the provisions in there. And I think in our conversation we'll get a chance to go into a lot of those specific things in more detail. But I want to say a couple things real quickly about, in a broader sense, because we do work nationally, and I think a lot of these issues have some real national implications. A lot of people call these things place-based wilderness bills. Language matters, and all of you know that as journalists. I think really what they are is just another version of the old local control debates that we've been having for a long, long time on public lands. I've been working on public land issues for over 30 years now as a citizen activist. And I sort of, when I was cutting my teeth, it was in the height of the Sagebrush Rebellion, which some of you may remember the Sagebrush Rebellion, you may not. But it's very similar sorts of arguments about the need to sort of, what Jack Ward Thomas warned against when he was chief of the Forest Service, this devolution of control of public lands from sort of a national level down to the local level. It's not changing ownership of the land, but it's changing control over those lands and decision making over those lands. And this is really another way to do that. It's nothing new. It's the same sort of backroom deal making that has always affected public lands. It has some different partners in the room, if you will, now than it always has, but it has the characteristic of those who are in the room divide up the pie and those who aren't in the room don't get a piece. And so if your interest, whether it's in wilderness preservation, wilderness stewardship, whether it's in other aspects of public lands and what's happening on those lands, preserving endangered species or whatever, you don't have a seat at the table, your interests might be compromised in order for these other interests to get their piece of the pie. So it's just another way of doing things that we have, but I think fundamentally, one of our biggest concerns, and I'll leave it with this, is sort of the balkanization of public lands that is a result of this. John mentioned that it's called a Montana solution. This is a Montana solution, but these are federal lands. These are national lands that belong to everybody. And I'd hate to see what an Alaska solution to drilling in the Arctic Refuge would look like, or a Wyoming solution to snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park. Or an Idaho solution to logging Idaho's national forests, especially when we had folks like Larry Craig in office. These are national lands, and I think that we need to preserve those national laws and those national overlays and those national interests that are part of these lands, because they do belong to everybody. They're the birthright of all Americans. And then we can find some local solutions working within the confines of those existing laws on these lands, because decisions always have been largely, at the ground level, have always been a function of local decision making. But to go in and start rewriting laws and to let senators write forest plans, essentially, for forests in their states, I think this sort of balkanization poses a real threat to our public lands in general, and this notion that they are indeed public federal lands that belong to all people.
Thank you, George. Martin?
I'll just make a couple quick comments to start off. I tried to put together a few ideas that I thought might be of interest to the group, but they're not really focused on Senator Tester's bill, but more about the politics and compromise in wilderness legislation. So I'll just throw a couple big ticket items out there. First, you know, former Solicitor of the Interior John Leschi put forward a few years ago this idea that there's a split in the wilderness movement between idealists and pragmatists. On the one hand, you have say wilderness idealists that believe that, you know, conservationists are making too many deals and too many compromises for too small of wilderness areas. And on the other hand, you have the pragmatists that rightfully point out that wilderness has always been about compromise and negotiation from the 1964 Act on. I think instead of Red Sox Yankees, you have folks like George Nickus on the one side versus maybe Doug Scott, the Campaign for America's Wilderness, on the other. So we've had this debate in the past. A compromise has certainly always been part of wilderness law, the drawing of lines on maps, special provisions, what to designate as wilderness versus the release of other lands, whatever. So compromise has always been part of wilderness legislation. But what's important to point out, I think, is the importance of precedent in those laws as well. That once used, when you go through that legislation and you find particular language relevant to grazing or to water infrastructure or other items, those provisions end up getting stamped as a matter of course on subsequent wilderness legislation. And I think this helps explain some of the concern conservation groups have about Senator Tester's bill and other legislation that has more explicit economic development provisions written into the legislation. And I think a lot of this concern began in 2002, George, with the Nevada legislation, Clark County bills and others, where instead of some of these very traditional compromises over the release to multiple use, you had more explicit economic development provisions written into the wilderness legislation itself. Transmission lines, land sales, and all sorts of economic goodies thrown into there. And so I think that a lot of wilderness politics today is still influenced by some of that Nevada legislation. I think the Boulder White Clouds bill, CEDRA in Idaho, is a good example of that. And the other thing I would just throw out to get us started maybe is to point out that wilderness politics has always been about the context. And I think the context is changing the debate over wilderness in a lot of ways. And I think that is newsworthy. When you consider the politics of forest restoration, for example, as Tim talked about, I mean, forest restoration is really shaking up some traditional political alliances. And when forest restoration is then packaged in a wilderness bill, it kind of puts the debate on a different trajectory. I think the debate over motorized recreation and roadless lands does the same thing. And I think even what we're seeing right now is that energy law and policy is having some interesting impacts on wilderness legislation as well. I just got done taking a look at this gargantuan California Desert Protection Act of 2010, all 200 pages of it or so, 250 pages of it. And you have tucked into this huge bill a bunch of wilderness and national monument designations and so on. And 194 pages later, you have a lot of very site-specific information about how to deal with renewable energy in California and throughout the western United States. So I think you're seeing more of that sort of omnibus approach, obviously, and it raises a number of really interesting policy questions. So a couple questions we might want to talk about is whether or not wilderness legislation is the appropriate vehicle to deal with some of those related and not so related conservation measures like renewable energy. And the second question that I'd be interested to hear Tim and George talk about is whether or not this tension between idealism and pragmatism is whether or not it's a healthy tension to have. Now, I think we have this in most social movements, a tension between idealists and pragmatists. But I get the sense in Montana sometimes that the two viewpoints are working at cross purposes. It, to the disadvantage of wilderness law and to the disadvantage of conservation. So those are some sort of general frames maybe that we could talk about these issues.
Well, that actually leads in perfectly. I was going to ask Tim to start with. When we talk about compromise and the need for compromise, and you talked about the fact that the difference between wilderness in a local community sense and then wilderness designation in a political sense. What has changed in the last 20 years? Why are we moving into an... Explain the need for the compromise. Let's talk about that.
Okay. I'm actually really glad you asked that. Compromise, I don't really see this, and we often get portrayed as a compromise, and the title of this workshop soapbox is compromise. I don't really see this as a compromise. I think there are dramatic changes occurring in the West right now, particularly in Montana, and I think that it is totally reshuffling the deck so that we're now seeing the emergence of a different paradigm. Now, I'm a wilderness guy, so is George. I mean, probably some of you are too. And it's been, 27 years since there was a new wilderness. So from a wilderness guy's perspective, right, I do want to try to figure out a way to bring wilderness back to where it's possible to do it. But I think some of the things that are going on in the state, you have the New West showing up, which is really bringing substantial changes not only to the region, but particularly to Montana. You have forests that are undergoing dramatic change because of climate change, which is challenging fisheries and wildlife. You have the wood products industry, which is mostly gone from western Montana, but which still exists in some of the smaller communities in the state. Really still, and that's for a variety of reasons, still hanging on and still being critical to rural communities. So when I think about this, I think about really bringing a new paradigm, one that operates socially, economically, and politically, and it builds a new mainstream around forest management, the bigger issue of forest management. And that mainstream includes not just jobs in the woods, not just restoration, but also wilderness. We'd really love to have wilderness back in kind of the mainstream of political thought in this state, and it hasn't been there for a long time. So that's why I think this bill is so important. I think it builds a new mainstream around these issues that bring rural and urban Montanans together. It brings hunters and fishers, it brings these new coalitions together for a bigger vision of how our national forests can be addressed, which includes wilderness designation.
George, he raises some good points there, and most importantly is the fact that we haven't had new wilderness designation in so long. Is it time for a new approach, or what's wrong with the way things are going?
You know, I one of the early issues I worked on in wilderness, I'm a native of Utah, and it was getting a wilderness bill passed in Utah back in 1984, and we had an all-Republican delegation, none of whom ever distinguished themselves as environmental or wilderness champions. But we got a wilderness bill passed. The only thing that has, and you know, Tim's organization has said many, many times, pointed out how the public comment in support of the roadless rule and things like that was overwhelmingly in support of preserving all the roadless lands in Montana. I don't think Montana's attitudes toward wilderness are any worse, if you will, than in many other western states that have continued to pass wilderness bills. We simply have not had a wilderness champion in our delegation. That's what distinguishes Montana from other western states. Other western states that have had wilderness bills have had a wilderness champion, and so they've passed wilderness bills. There are lots of places in Montana where you could pass a wilderness bill right today without a lot of controversy. So we could do that if the focus was on passing wilderness bills. And I think that really is what's, you can debate whether or not the various conservation groups have had the right strategies and whether or not, a lot of emphasis was put on the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act years ago, which would designate 23 million acres
in several states in the Northern Rockies, and whether or not the focus should have been different. But ultimately, it just comes down to, we haven't had a member of our delegation. Tim's right. Wilderness bills are passed by local delegations. We haven't had a delegation member who was a wilderness champion. And what's happening now is, because wilderness has always been sort of a holy grail to the conservation movement, the public lands conservation movement, I think the opponents of wilderness have realized that. Politicians have realized that. And they think we're willing to trade a hell of a lot in order to put a wilderness designation on a piece of land. And that's ultimately what's happening now, is these other groups are coming around and saying, hey, in Oregon, which is where it really started with Steens Mountain, people, the ranchers got a great deal. They got 100,000 acres of public lands for 5,000 acres. What a giveaway. They got $5 million in their pockets for part of the deal. Everybody got all this stuff. We got all this stuff we want. So let's go for a wilderness bill, and we'll get what we want out of this bill. And I don't think that's a very good way to be setting public land policy, frankly.
Martin raised another interesting question, which is this tension between the pragmatists and the idealists. I'd ask you guys, how would you describe that tension, and is it good for the overall goal, or is it creating such a rift that it's difficult to move forward at all?
I don't think it's good or it's bad. I just think it is. It exists. You can take any issue that you want to look at in this country, and climate change, healthcare. We could spend the afternoon talking about healthcare, and you're going to have idealists and you're going to have pragmatists. And I've got lots of good friends who are idealists, and I'm glad they're out there. But idealism comes with a cost, and the pragmatists are the ones who are going to roll up the sleeves and are going to go into the room and are going to find the ways to get things done and try to move the agenda forward. The idealists are going to remind us of whether those deals are good or bad, whether the core values have been lost or violated. But the reality of it is that it's going to be done by the pragmatists, and there's a cost to idealism. And the cost is that you may find yourself sitting on the outside looking in. So I don't see it as good or bad. I like our critics. I know most of them personally and actually like them and think they're great people, but we just look at the world differently. What about you, George?
I think it's bad, and I'll explain that in just a minute. But I'll also add, I don't think it's as clear cut about who's an idealist and who's a pragmatist. And I don't know if it's an idealist to think that our existing public land laws, all of which were a result of compromise at one time, that believing those existing public land laws are good and we ought to uphold them. I mean, if that's idealism, we've set the bar awfully damn low in our culture about what being an idealist is. I think about somebody like Howard Zonizer, who was the chief author of the Wilderness Act and his advocate. He was very politically pragmatic in the ability to get that bill passed, but I don't think there's anybody who's more of an idealist than Howard Zonizer was in the ideals that he projected in trying to get a wilderness system established and those kinds of things. So I think it's hard to put any of us in that type of a box. I think it's bad from this perspective. There are a lot of issues out there that are challenging public lands, which if the conservation community was working more in unison on those issues, we could be making a lot more progress. There has been a tremendous amount of resources, money, time, energy, emotional energy, goodwill spent on a handful of what I consider to be very destructive, bad wilderness bills in the West. And I think that it has actually retarded our ability to make progress on a lot of issues where we probably have a lot more in common and could be making progress. So I agree diversity is good in the movement. We're not all going to agree. We're probably as fragmented a group of people as exists on the planet. Every time one of us gets mad at the people we work with, we go start our own organization, and off we go. That exists in the environmental movement without doubt. But But a lot of it has been very, I think, destructive and wasteful divisiveness, really.
Martin, you've looked at...
We can't even agree on that.
Martin, you've looked at this in a real broad context from an academic approach. You've talked about... you were talking about the precedent. What are, I guess, the long-term ramifications for something like, you know, your paper discussed place-based wilderness. What are some of the long-term national ramifications for each individual place-based wilderness bill?
Well, you know, my work has looked at place-based national forest legislation, not because I would argue that all wilderness laws are essentially place-based,
sure.
Right? I mean, you have the Wilderness Act, this sort of umbrella statute, and subsequent to 1964, Congress passes site-specific wilderness bills with various provisions in them. So wilderness is place-based. What I think is so precedential about Senator Tester's bill is the degree of specificity and prescription in how to manage the released lands, basically. So instead of just having a wilderness bill and making choices that we're going to release so many acres to multiple use management, what this does, which is so precedential, is say, okay, we're going to release these lands, basically, but we're going to do so with very site-specific prescriptions on how these released lands are to be managed over the next decades. So I think that's what's precedential. And the concern then becomes if there is a treatment mandate or a timber supply mandate, depending on how you read that bill, what precedent does that set? So even if you agree, for example, that the acreage numbers in Tester's bill are sustainable and could be done, the concern, of course, is what happens if all of a sudden timber treatment mandates are now politically acceptable west-wide. What is going to happen to all of the ongoing collaborations throughout the West? I mean,
Are you saying that it takes, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is then it takes the management decisions for these individual public lands out of the hands of the agencies designated to manage them and into the hands of the politicians who are passing these laws?
Sure.
Is that what you're...
Yeah, and it's not so black and white. I mean, there's still a lot of discretion that the Forest Service would have under Senator Tester's bill, Senator Wyden's bill, and others, but it certainly limits the amount of discretion the Forest Service would have in managing those forests. Yeah.
You had also talked about earlier, asked the question whether or not wilderness legislation is an appropriate vehicle for these other goals.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would pose that question to the two of you.
I don't look at it as, perhaps not surprisingly, right, as just about wilderness legislation. I look at it as about legislation, the bigger issue of legislation. The Wilderness Act is, you know, we're so fortunate that we have the Wilderness Act, and it was a visionary, still is, a visionary piece of legislation. And it was the result, as George mentioned, of, you know, and I'll channel Doug Scott just for a second, 150 rewrites and 8 years to get it passed and, you know, 150 versions. And there are provisions in there that are not necessarily consistent with anybody's philosophy of what wilderness would be, right? For example, grazing, which is allowed to continue, just as one example. But what happened after that was Congress said, our legislative tradition is going to be that the local delegation is going to have a lot of influence over what happens when we designate wilderness in their state. And I think that they did that for a reason. And they did that because they recognized that although we have this national program, and although we have this national ideal, when you designate wilderness, and when you designate wilderness in a particular state, the impacts are going to fall disproportionately, good or bad, on that particular state. And so we don't want to make it solely about national politics. We want to make sure that, you know, in the phrase of all politics is local, and wilderness politics even more so. We want to make sure that there is still some local consideration that goes on here. Now, wilderness itself is this. I think that we need to be careful, because the Wilderness Act, it's an overlay, but it doesn't remove wilderness from the greater forest landscape. And I think that what's happened over the years is that we have elevated wilderness to this, you know, ideal, which is great, except that we've almost removed it from the rest of the landscape. And I think what we need to do is, I think we need to bring it back as a legitimate part of the rest of the forest landscape. And I think that's what Senator Tester's bill does. It brings it back into context. That while you're designating wilderness, which is the Holy Grail, I mean, George is absolutely right, and it is the ideal, there are also other things that happen on these public lands.
George, your thoughts?
Remind me what the question
was. Well, whether Martin had raised the question whether or not wilderness bills, wilderness legislation, is an appropriate vehicle for some of the other goals.
No, I don't. For all the reasons that we've been talking about, I think that wilderness is becoming a bargaining chip for a whole bunch of other things. I think the wilderness system was far better off when wilderness bills argued about where the boundaries of a wilderness ought to be, and not where wilderness got caught up in whether or not we ought to be running pipelines to suck all the water out of central Nevada in order to feed Las Vegas, and how the trade-offs that exist there would affect what ends up inside the wilderness bill, et cetera. I don't think it's been good for the wilderness system at all. And I don't really think, although I guess at a certain level I agree with Tim that I don't think the Wilderness Act or I don't think the wilderness bills have done anything to separate wilderness from the rest of the landscape. I don't think that wilderness designations have necessarily taken the full consideration of how wilderness fits with the rest of the landscape. But the problem is almost 180 degrees different than I think what Tim is saying. The problem is our wildernesses can't exist as islands, and therefore how we manage the rest of the landscape defines how well these wildernesses will exist, if you will, into the future. But what's happening in these political trade-offs isn't that we're doing better on the rest of the landscape because we're designating wilderness. What we're doing is we're mandating logging, and we're mandating ORV use, and we're mandating all these incompatible activities on the rest of that landscape that are making it these wildernesses even more of an island than they would be otherwise. So I don't think it has served wilderness well at all. It has perhaps allowed some wilderness bills to pass. Maybe the wilderness system would be 106 million acres instead of 110 million acres because of all these trade-offs, but I don't think these trade-offs are doing wilderness any good at all.
Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I mean, I guess I would throw out the, you know, increasingly we're seeing wilderness legislation passed in omnibus style, so you have just these massive bills that go through with the last 2009 omnibus law had 160 different pieces of legislation included within it. So that vehicle, you know, the question is whether or not that provides an incentive to put some of these extraneous provisions in there. I don't know what to make of it. You know, when you go through that last omnibus bill, you had a number of pretty straightforward, uncontroversial wilderness designations, and then you had some of the more controversial ones included in it. So that's something to consider. And I think, you know, with a lot of these package deals, I mean, I understand the politics of it. I mean, it helps interest groups coalesce and build coalitions, and it makes sense. And I also think that a lot of the goals that are part of these package deals are laudable. I mean, to consolidate BLM holdings in Nevada, for example, or restoration needs. These are all laudable goals, but the question is whether or not they should be packaged in a wilderness law. And if it sets a particular precedent that the only way you're going to get wilderness is by having all of these extraneous provisions. And I think rightfully, you know, we should be rightfully concerned about that precedent.
And if I might, John, let me just add one other thing real quickly. I think one of the other distinctions is that wilderness designation, for a lot of the reasons Tim talked about, lends itself to congressional action. I mean, it requires, by law, it requires legislation. But it should. It's that kind of a designation. It needs that kind of permanence. It lends itself to that. Making decisions about how to manage a piece of land in terms of how much we should be logging it and what areas should allow for off-road vehicles and those kinds of things, I think those are decisions that are far better left to a more of a planning process than they are to having congressmen making those kinds of decisions. And that's the kind of stuff that's getting larded in the wilderness bills in order to get it through. But most of that stuff would never pass on its own, so it gets attached to a wilderness bill so it could get through.
Well, I want to leave plenty of time for questions. Just a show of hands, how many folks plan to ask a question? Yeah, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Well, I want to make sure we got plenty of time for that, and I imagine the questions are going to give these guys plenty to work with. So let's move on to that. And first and foremost, SEJ members and members of the Working Press, you guys get first crack. So let's see. Who had a question? Go ahead. And please, please identify yourself and try to speak loudly. Identify yourself, who you're with, and speak loud and clear.
Sure. Alisa Opar with Audubon Magazine. I'm wondering, in terms of Tester's bill, what sort of planning went into the forest management part? Who was consulted? Who had input into what that will look like?
Well, the bill, as I mentioned, really rests on three different collaborative efforts that were ongoing. And so, to pull one of them apart and talk about, like, the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Partnership, for example, is what started off as three conservation groups, Montana Wilderness Association, Montana Trout Unlimited, and the National Wildlife Federation, and five members of the timber industry. And we were first asked to, by the Forest Service, as to whether we could come up with, we were given 4 months to see if we could come up with something that we could all agree on that dealt with timber management, dealt with wilderness, dealt with restoration issues. So those, and that kind of framework kind of plays out over all of the other collaboratives. It's kind of similar. You have a mix of conservation groups, some local, some national, and then members of the industry. That I'll just add, I mean, because you kind of referenced the bill. So since then, right, Senator Tester agreed, yes, I'll do this, and then spent the next year and a half with his staff out talking to other stakeholders and kind of, you know, expanding the coalition of the willing to include other national groups, including like the Wilderness Society, Greater Yellowstone Coalition, Backcountry Horsemen, you know, mountain bikers, different constituencies that were willing to, at least when the senator asked, right, willing to come to the table and also participate in crafting the bill and how it looked.
Laura?
Yeah. Laura Lundquist, I'm with the Twin Falls Times News. And I guess I'd classify myself in the idealist party there. However, I know that since a lot of the original wilderness bills were passed, there's been a lot more groups coming on board. We didn't have the motorized vehicle group when a lot of those were passed and all this. So I struggle because it's like, well, can we ever pass anything at this rate, the way that legislation is going and whatnot? But I still cling to the thing of untrammeled by man. This is what wilderness is. And a lot of these bills are creating wilderness that are trammeled by man. And so just was wondering if it was ever going to be a possibility, perhaps, because I don't want to give up that wilderness ideal, and it is an ideal, so the idealist should cling to it, I think. But could there be maybe a different designation made for these lands we're trying to preserve that have those protections, that but you still allow these inner other groups joining in on things like this, but it doesn't water down that wilderness thing that, when you go back to the original bill, was amazingly watered down to begin with. You know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to manage for the future, put yourself 100 years into the future when the population is expanding. All we have is our 4% that we have right now left. You know, if you're going to keep picking that apart, what are we going to have left at that point?
So, Laura, the question you talked about is a separate designation.
Yeah.
So,
is that possible instead of making it a wilderness and jobs bill, can we make it a something else and jobs bill?
But just to clarify here, at least at some level, and there's two different things that you're talking about in your question. One is the wilderness that's being created as wilderness? And what about the, you know, exceptions that occur for different activities, which George's group is an expert on and they do great work on, and we don't always agree, of course, but that's okay. But the jobs piece is not related, for the most part, to the wilderness piece. Okay? That's taking place on the eroded landscape, lands that, by and large, you know, are never going to, very unlikely that they would ever be actively considered for wilderness.
Right. No, but it's just
yeah.
you're combining them. So obviously.
Most of the places in this bill, and George and I will argue over, you know, the handful of exceptions that are in there, but most of the 670,000 acres in this bill is actually managed as wilderness. I mean, it is absolute wilderness, and there are very few conflicting activities that are going to take place. So there's a couple of exceptions, and your special designations one, and George and I could talk about the Highlands, because the Highlands is a great example of that. When Senator Tester introduced his bill, he wanted to designate 20,000 acres south of Butte Highlands, spectacular place. It had communications towers in it. It had the water City of Butte pipeline in it for water supply, and they would go up and down and, you know, deal with it. And it had, like three times a year, Air National Guard helicopters landing in it. Okay? Now, when we brought the proposal forward, we had met with the City of Butte, we had met with the owners of the communications towers, and we had met with the National Guard guy, and we had said, look, we really want this to be wilderness. We think we can work through these issues with you. But, you know, we want to get the bill introduced. Gets the bill introduced. Senator Tester's staff heard from City of Butte, owners of the communications towers, George's group, who said, hey, wait a second. You know, this is over the top. You can't have National Guard helicopters landing in wilderness because then it's not wilderness. So Senator Tester said, all right, I'm going to carve it up, and I'm going to take out that area where those things happen. I'm going to give that a special designation, as George's group suggested. The rest of it's going to stay wilderness because it's still pristine and it's still wilderness and it'll be managed just like wilderness. The rest of this part's going to be managed just like wilderness, except, right?
Like a corridor?
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the what you have here in the Missoula rattlesnake?
Yeah,
the corridor that runs up the middle.
It's more substantial.
It's a recreation.
Yeah, kind of a... So, and then you have other designations, right? You have, I mean, we have some of what we've argued about here. We have designations for mountain bike areas. Mountain biking is incompatible with wilderness. So instead of creating wilderness and saying, and you can ride your mountain bikes there, which a lot of mountain bikers would love, we said no. But we will look at some areas and say, but this is suitable for mountain bike use, and this would be an area where it gets managed for mountain bike use. Same thing with snowmobilers and motorized users. The classic example is, you know, the West Pioneers, a place where snowmobilers have been snowmobiling since 1973. A lot of that area is going to be managed for that use. Doesn't mean the agency can't still protect other values, but snowmobiling is going to be allowed there.
George, Martin, do you guys have anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, a couple things. One, you started off the question with the motorized recreation issue. And I think that's a newsworthy story. The question of, from my standpoint, there seems to be a split in the conservation community in terms of how great of threat motorized recreation is to future wilderness designation. It seems that on one side you have those that feel that it is the greatest threat that has eclipsed logging, really, in terms of future wilderness designation. And there's an urgency there to protect those inventoried roadless lands, because every month that you don't, you fail to do so, you're going to lose more and more of that acreage to possible future.
Is that because the motorized vehicles go in, they use the area, they leave their mark?
They establish a historic use. So what agencies like the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest have done is give a particular area a very high wilderness quality or capability score, but then say they're not going to recommend this area as wilderness. And one of the reasons is because of existing motorized use. So you look at that story, and part of the conservation community says, you know, we don't have the time to wait for the perfect, unblemished wilderness bill, because if we do so, if we wait for a NAREPA or something else, we're going to lose increasing amounts of these lands to possible future wilderness designation. And on the other hand, you know, maybe, again, this is the idealist-pragmatist divide. You have others that say, this is such a great threat, let's just get something now and protect as much acreage as we possibly can. I think that's an interesting divide that I've sensed.
Let me say a couple things. I do think that, first of all, with respect to Senator Tester's bill and the areas that it does designate as wilderness, you know, I've got 5 pages of things that are incompatible with the wilderness system with respect to Senator Tester's bill, and I think it's indicative of the fact that some folks, Tim and others, don't see those conflicts with wilderness designation as an indication of how it makes a point that Martin made earlier, how these precedents get set, and they start to get embedded in people's mind that, oh, so that's okay in wilderness, and we're sort of dumbing down wilderness consistently and lowering the bar. So there are a lot of concerns that way. I think that and we've advocated alternative designations in a lot of places. If you don't want it to be wilderness, like is described in the Wilderness Act, or better, why are all the compromises always weakening this protections in the Wilderness Act? We all admit that there were some things in there we wish weren't in the wilderness system. How come we're not going in the other direction? We don't have the barrens of yesteryear. We don't have the giant timber industry and grazing industry and mining industry that controls everything like they did in 1950s and 1960s. Why aren't we moving the other direction? It's always weakening, 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 weakening. If we don't want to designate it as wilderness, if we don't want to manage it as wilderness, we don't want it to be wilderness, then let's call it something else. And we can prohibit logging in it if we want. We can prohibit ORVs. We have all kinds of designations we can use. I think that's a much better approach than chipping away at that wilderness system we have and at that wilderness ideal, which needs to be strengthened, not weakened.
Let's get some more questions. Who else had a question?
My question is actually very related to Montana. My name is Andrew. I'm a graduate student here at the University of Montana. And speaking of precedents, I was wondering if, so obviously this bill would have the potential to create a slippery slope for future legislation in other parts of the United States, but are there any other precedents that have been set that are similar in other areas, or were you looking in creating this bill to other similar cases? Or is this really a completely unique, one-of-a-kind?
Testers?
Yes.
No, there are some examples that are not perfect analogs, but the Tongass Timber Reform Act of 1994 had protected land designations in it, and also very site-specific provisions on how to manage 17 million acres in Southeast Alaska. You have temporary legislation that covered national forests in the Pacific Northwest during the logging wars that had some treatment mandates. And then most recently you had the infamous Quincy Library Group legislation that had some treatment mandates as well. So on that score, there is a precedent. And the historical record isn't exactly very compelling that just because you legislate some of those mandates that they ever happen.
Thanks, Martin. Eve?
Tim, I was wanting to know, you know, there's always been the question that's out there, as a pragmatic person, what's the cost of this? And we've never been able to get a real answer, especially where the logging is concerned, that who's going to pay for it, and what happens if they can't hit those goals, whether there's, you know, with the timber market being as it is, the closing of the sawmills. What is the cost, and who's going to pay that cost of undertaking some of these activities?
Well, you know, it depends on which aspect of it, Eve, that you pick up on. I mean, if the timber markets are cyclical, first of all, I mean, they always have been, and they will, you know, values will change over time. And I think there's, you know, there are also dollars that are, then you have the cost of the Forest Service, right, that the agency is very concerned about whether they're going to have the money to do the work. And I think, you know, that's probably, I know they've been given assurances by Senator Tester's staff that they will have the resources that they need in order to make sure they can do this work, which is not additive, right? It's just, it's actually taking the work that they do now and adding to it and changing the way they do it.
Although they have some concerns.
They absolutely have some concerns, yeah. And you know, I think that's a legitimate issue. We want this to work, so we want to make sure the agency has the resources it needs. Then I think there are the costs that are associated with restoration activities. And we're using, you know, as you know, a mechanism called stewardship contracting that allows you to take the receipts that are generated by harvesting trees on public land and then take those receipts and feed them back into restoration activities. Well, that's great, except that, of course, the timber markets right now are not very good, and so prices are pretty low, so it's expected that they won't generate a lot of money. And I do think that we are going to have to probably rely at least partially on appropriated dollars. But the types of activities we're talking about, rolling up roads, fixing culverts, fixing fisheries, there happen to be a lot of appropriated dollars available, a lot of funds that are already out there, some pretty substantial funds that have been put forth by Congress and by the administration to fund that kind of activity on public land. So I think at least partially we have to tap into those resources to make sure that these activities happen.
But chances are, if we're going to do this logging, that we probably will be paying for the logging rather than having it in today's market. I mean, if this bill were to pass tomorrow and be implemented next year in this today's market, chances are that we would be paying the cost for removing the timber from there.
Well, I guess I don't really follow what you're saying there. I mean, the agency plans sales and does activities. They're going to do that now, whether we pass this bill or not.
But they're right. Getting a lot of timber sales where nobody's bidding on them.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the mandate, the
yeah.
mandated levels of logging, and,
yeah.
and if nobody wants to buy that wood, but the law says that it has to be done,
yeah.
who's
yeah.
going to pay to have
yeah.
it logged? Is that the question?
No, that's not going to happen. We're not going to go out and hire somebody to go in and harvest trees. It says it shall be placed under contract. So if nobody bids on the contract, there is no contract. I mean, I think the agency then, if, you know, I don't foresee somebody going to court and suing the agency saying, you know, you're not placing under contract this amount of trees when they're putting it out there, but people aren't bidding on them to put it under contract.
George, it sounds like you have some thoughts on that.
Even under the... When timber prices were high, logging on these forests was heavily subsidized by the public. It's always cost the public more money to lay out the timber sales and administer the timber sales than the government has received in receipts. They've always been below-cost timber sales. Under this market and in the marginal habitats that they're talking about a lot of this logging, the cost to the public is, I've seen numbers as high as $100 million. We've asked Senator Tester's office to give us numbers and none have been forthcoming. It's going to cost a boatload of money to do it. And, yeah, some cells aren't under contract, but they set a minimum bid price and nobody bids on it because the minimum bid price is too high. So eventually they will have to give it away or pay somebody to come in and log it to try to meet the goals that they're being mandated to meet by Congress. The Forest Service has raised a lot of these concerns. The other thing is, Tim mentioned restoration a little bit ago, and there are some good restoration provisions in the bill, and there's talk about putting money into that restoration. But remember, you know, we're in a country that has incredible deficits right now. We're in a country that isn't looking for places to spend money. All the talk we're hearing politically is, how do we save money? Is that money going to be available? And one of the things, concerns the Forest Service has raised, and many of others have raised, is that with this legislation, the region is going to be forced, the Forest Service is going to be forced to put its restoration money into these projects. They don't have enough money for restoration, for the amount of restoration that needs to occur, but they're not mandated to spend it in other places. They're going to be mandated to spend it here. Maybe there's far more high-value restoration that needs to be done on other forests in this region or in other regions around the country. The Forest Service is going to be mandated to spend money here. This is where the money's going to go, and everybody in the Forest Service knows this. It's not unlike several years ago when Salt Lake City got the Olympics, and the Wasatch Cache National Forest sucked all the recreation money out of Region 4 to fund getting ready for the Olympics, and every other forest had to give up their money for recreation so Salt Lake could host the Olympics. The Wasatch Cache National Forest could host the Olympics. It's a similar kind of thing. These kind of mandates might be great if you're the person sitting around the table dividing up the pie and you get your piece of that mandate. But when you look at it in the bigger context of the state, the region, the nation, it's where it starts to get complicated. This is one of the reasons that these issues have gotten so controversial, is because the implications, the ramifications are a lot bigger than just what happens on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge or the Yak or wherever.
Tim, I'll let you respond to that real briefly, but I do want to get a couple more questions in, so let's...
I just wanted to make sure people understand. I've not sat in on the conversations between Senator Tester's staff and the Forest Service, but I do understand that they have committed to what I call kind of the robbing Peter to pay Paul language that would, in fact, prevent the kind of siphoning off of funds that George is concerned about. So I do think that's an issue that was raised by the agency, and I think Senator Tester's office has... endeavor to address that.
So. Who else had a question? We have a few more questions.
Please identify yourself.
Yeah.
I'm
not a member of SEJ, so it's...
Okay. Are there any other members of SEJ or any other working journalists who had a question? Otherwise, I'll let these guys go. Okay, go ahead.
Or am I a working journalist?
You're welcome.
Thank you. I have a question for the journalists in the room, as opposed to these...
Please identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. My name is Chris Barnes. I'm with the Washington Office of the Bureau of Land Management. Okay. I have a question for the journalists in this room. How do you cover this story? Okay? Now, forgive me if I paint with too broad a brush. Those of you who have not covered this story, you're off the hook. If I'm painting too broad a brush with those, some of you in the room who have covered this story, please forgive me. But what I see when I read the local paper, gosh, maybe there's someone from the Missoulian in here, is I see a quote from Tim, a quote from George. We've covered the story. If we're really diligent, someone gets a hold of Martin, who has been studying this and knows more about the history and the depths of this policy decision than anyone else, who has been invited to talk here.
What's wrong with a quote from Tim and George?
So my question is, there are clearly some affected parties who are not up there with name tags on and happen to be sitting in the back row of the room. Some of them can speak directly to this piece of legislation. Some cannot, but can speak to, for instance, wilderness legislation in general. I know you are all pressed with fewer people on your staff, whatever news organization you work with. How, you know, I've got to cover this tomorrow, today, and tomorrow I'm covering the Humane Society, whatever it is. I know that, but I'm seeing very superficial coverage of environmental issues. I imagine that's kind of been one of the themes of your week, is how do we enrich the coverage of environmental issues. I just would ask you to think about who else needs to be having some input here.
Appreciate the feedback. And we have one more question over here.
That's okay. Do folks want to respond to that?
Well, I think it was more a rhetorical question directed at us journalists than...
Oh, well, wait a second. We have to respond. We have to respond. Why don't you respond?
Because this is your soapbox. I want to make sure we got enough time to ask the... I mean, I think what he's saying is there are more resources and more sources out there than maybe what we've been in. As a journalist who occasionally covers this, I'd be interested in finding out what some more of those are and who some of these other affected people are. But in the meantime, before we're out of time, I want to get to any other last questions we might have had.
Yeah, I'm Ann Pumbles with the Brainerd Foundation, and we fund conservation efforts in the Northwest. My question, this has been a really fascinating panel. Congratulations to all of you. I feel my heartstrings getting pulled, and my intellect is fabulous. So thank you for a really fascinating last hour or so. I was going to ask, especially George, if you don't mind, because of your idealistic position on this, what I've heard, you know, my heart is with you, and yet when I talk to activists out in the field that are more on the idealistic side, some of them say, for example, the ones that are working on Boulder White Clouds right now, that some of the best wilderness areas have already been designated and we're sort of at the next level, so it's going to require some more compromise. I'm just telling you what they say.
Yeah.
And it was going to require some more compromise, and also that if we don't do it now, that like Martin was saying, some of those areas are going to get trampled on, and then there won't be wilderness if we wait another 5 or 10 years. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Good question. I think that it's true in some cases that the easiest areas, let's put it that way, have been designated. Certainly in Montana and in Idaho, there's still a lot of wild country that's as wild and spectacular as what was ever designated. It's still to be designated. I think it gets back a little bit. I mean, I have a couple answers. One is it gets back to what we said earlier, which is if it's not. I mean, they're almost saying that it's not wilderness. It's something less than wilderness, so we can't put the wilderness label on it. If that's the way we feel about it, let's call it something else. Let's prohibit those things we don't want to go on in there, and let's promote those things we do want to go on. But let's not call it wilderness if that's not what we want it to be designated. But I also think I just don't think that it's true that we can't still designate areas under the Wilderness Act. It's still happening in many parts of this country. There's still a lot of wilderness bills. The majority of wilderness bills that are being passed in Congress now are so-called clean wilderness bills. It's when we start getting into some of these other issues, some of these processes, the Boulder White Clouds being an example, some of the others where a lot of these sort of compromises have been made that have caused a lot of problems.
Martin?
Self-consciously saying this with Chris in the room and George and Tim, but you know, you'd wonder if you were to study the database of wilderness legislation, that if you look at the sort of straightforward designations of rocks and ice, you know, the alpine, subalpine areas, pretty straightforward. And as you move down in elevation, that you're going to get greater compromise or debate about some of those areas. I mean, I think you think of the most litigated wilderness of all, the Boundary Waters. The recent debate over the Awakis, for example. So that might be the importance of this theme today, compromise, that you're going to see that even more in the future as we work down in elevation. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and partly because if you look back at the debates when the Wilderness Act was passed and what
people perceived would eventually become desert wilderness. Leave BLM out of it for the moment, because BLM lands were not even in the original Wilderness Act. But I think our in our own minds, what qualifies for wilderness has changed a little bit. We give far more latitude to previous developments and roads and stuff like that, and we put a lot of areas in the system that have a kind of developments in them that we wouldn't have considered wilderness 30 or 40 years ago. So I think that is part of why we're seeing these kind of changes. And I think at the same time, if that pattern continues, you know, we hear this everybody likes to quote David Brower's thing about, you know, if we lose once, we've lost forever kind of a thing. Once an area loses wilderness, it's never going to be wilderness again. But you look at a lot of places that have been designated wilderness, and they lost their wilderness a long time ago, and they've recovered, they've restored. I look at the Wilderness Act as a forward-looking document. Wilderness is a forward-looking thing. It's how we're going to manage these areas in the future, not what happened in the past. And we've gotten a lot more liberal in our definition of what we're willing to call wilderness now in terms of what happened in the past. And that probably brings in a lot of these conflicts and controversies that we didn't used to deal with.
Did you have something you wanted to add to that, Tim?
Well, I really wanted a chance to respond to Ann's question, yeah. It may be that some of the areas that we're addressing today are what you might call second-tier wilderness areas, but they were not second-tier wilderness areas in the 1980s. And in the 1980s, for most of you that may not know this, President Reagan vetoed a statewide wilderness bill for Montana. So Montana became one of the two states that never went through this process in the 80s of designating a lot of areas. So as a result, when you look at the map today, you see lots of places that should have been designated 20 years ago and were not. And a lot of those places are in this bill. That veto created, unfortunately, a very difficult political dynamic to the point today to where the political culture in this state has grown up now a generation or two believing that wilderness is what you lose elections on. It is not what you win elections on. And when John Tester said he was going to introduce this bill, even with all of the horrible, horrific logging provisions in it, he was told, do not introduce this because the wilderness will sink you in 2012. And he persevered and said, no, I'm going to go ahead and do this. So really, part of what we're trying to do here is to undo that culture and to really kind of, you know, make the world safe for democracy, right? Make politics in Montana, you know, safe. Make wilderness safe for politics. So,
do we have any other questions?
We should start off a safe place.
Right. That's a great burn.
I would like to step away from the special provision aspect.
Can you please identify?
Oh, I'm sorry. Allison Perkins. I'm with the UN School of Journalism. And so stepping away from the special provisions, wilderness management is important. And I'm wondering if your different philosophies affect how you approach the towards wilderness, because I don't think the public understands wilderness in the same way that your personal philosophies might influence it, and so how that affects your thinking about wilderness management within this bill and in terms of broader legislation.
I think that's a really good question. I'd have to look at it and say, I mean, my answer would just be, you're right, the public doesn't embrace the nuances that George and I argue over when it comes to wilderness. I think for the most part, frankly, the public takes a walk out outside of town on Mount Helena, you know, where I live, and they walk out on Mount Helena and they get on the back side of it and they don't hear cars anymore and it's quiet and they feel like they're in wilderness. I do think that doesn't lessen the debate that we're having, and it doesn't lessen the importance of it, because I do think that the Wilderness Act was created to, you know, embrace this ideal. But I still look at it and think that, if a friend of mine, John Gatchel, were here, he's always handing those quotes. he would quote Aldo Leopold, who said something like, you know, even a slightly impaired wilderness is still better than no wilderness at all, or something like that. You know, that we still have a lot to gain from protecting places, even though they may not meet our perfect ideal.
And we got to wrap things up. But George, did you want to add to that?
I don't know what the public thinks, really. I wish I did. I see a lot of studies that are done on public attitudes about wilderness, and I usually scratch my head because I don't buy most of those. I don't think most people really know at least the wilderness that we're talking about in the wilderness system. But I think the ideal, to use that word again, is a very valuable one, and one that people appreciate and love. And I do know that oftentimes when I'm talking to people about wilderness and they say, "You mean you can graze in wilderness?" And I'll say, "Yeah." And you can tell that the idea of wilderness just kind of deflated a little bit in their mind as to how valuable it is. And I've talked to one of my board members is an outfitter, and he talks about the response of some of his clients when they encounter one of these non-conforming uses, if you will, in wilderness, and they find out that it's allowed. And he said they're deflated by it when they experience that. And that's one of the things that I really worry about, is that if we all found out that the Mona Lisa was a fake, how many people would go to see it, and how many people would care about it? Right now, I'll probably never see it. Most of us will probably never see it. We sort of care. We see that it has a value, a cultural value, of being preserved, and we hope it's protected. We hope somebody doesn't go in there and spray paint it. What happens is, as the ideal of what wilderness represents diminishes over time, if it does, in fact, diminish over time, I think the support for that will diminish. So that really influences a lot the way we approach these issues and look at it.
And Martin, did you have any final thoughts on that? Or
I was just thinking, what it'd be like to backpack with George in a federal designated wilderness.
Well, I want to thank
you.
I want to thank you guys for coming in and speaking with our group. Thank you all for coming today.